My name is Peter Ford. I was British ambassador in Damascus and before that in Bahrain. I'm a specialist in the Arab world, but I've also quite wide experience with the United States and Russia and matters geopolitical.
Now, but both those countries, Syria and Bahrain, have turned out to be very, you know, important hotspots. Can you say something, because we've just had the 12th anniversary, if people can believe that, of the Arab Spring, where there was actually quite a big uprising in Bahrain, wasn't there? And it was put down, you know, incredibly quickly by the authoritarian government there. Can you just say something about Bahrain? Because I know its history. It was just basically an island which was used for pearl fishing. But now it's become very important in a geostrategic sense.
Well, I think with hindsight, we can say that the conflict in Syria was a subset of the West's problems with Russia. Because the main reason the Western powers were determined to get regime change in Syria, and that's what the conflict started with, an attempt at regime change. The main reason was that Syria was a long-standing friend of Russia, and therefore the reasoning was that to topple the Syrian domino would be bad for Russia and the Russian sphere of influence in the Middle East and in the world. And to this day, this continues to be the case, that any rational person, any rational Western statesman would see that there's absolutely no chance now of overthrowing Assad, and that the humanitarian thing to do would be to normalize relations and stop sanctioning Syria. But no, they don't do that. Why? Because that would represent then a gain for Russia. Therefore, the rational, humane thing to do is ruled out of court immediately, because it would look like, in their eyes anyway, a win for Russia. Syria is paying the price for having been close to Russia.
What about Bahrain, though? Because this is another very important pinch point. British, supposedly, and then once the British handed them their independence, I think they only, in the 1970s, they only lasted for 2 years before there was an enormous government crackdown, a military crackdown, and the original constitution was overturned.
That's right. And the West looked away, because Bahrain was a client of the United States and Britain. And therefore, anything they did in terms of repression would be overlooked, quickly forgotten. While anybody like the Syrian leader, who did very similar things, would be put in the doghouse and attempts would be made to overthrow him. But Bahrain got away literally with murder, the murder of its own people, particularly the Shia majority in that country. The ruling family are a Sunni clique, a ruling clique who rule over a majority of both the poorer, ordinary Shia citizens. There's also a business class which is mostly Sunni as well. But like everything else in the Middle East, it comes down to religion. The war in Syria was, apart from being a scene for the West to interfere and play geopolitics against Russia, it was also a conflict between the forces of secularism, that is, not wanting to be run by mullahs and not wanting to have to abide by Sharia law, and that was the side chosen by the Syrian government and the majority of the Syrian people. And on the other side, the Sunni, 99% Sunni fundamentalists supported by the West. But in Bahrain, he had a similar setup in a way, a Sunni family ruling this this small but strategically important island, and all their sins were forgiven because they knew which side their bread was buttered on.
You're suggesting here that the West was behind the Syrian civil war. This is 2011, I believe it kicked off, around about the time of the Arab Spring. So the general public would say, well, hang on, because this was a genuine uprising, something called the Free Syrian Army, by disgruntled Syrians. And by goodness, you know, there were enough of those. And those, there was a genuine movement there because of all the tensions over the years, not least of which was the previous civil war. You know, there were just a lot of disgruntled people who genuinely, I mean, they were Syrian born and bred, wanted to overthrow Assad.
That's partly right for Tony. Certainly, following in the footsteps of the protesters on the streets of Cairo and Tunis, there were a handful of people in Syria who took to the streets of southern Syria, notably the city of Dera, very near the border with Jordan. But almost from day one, literally from day one, there were agents provocateurs who had been trained by the Western powers from bases in Jordan, where I happened to be at the time and knew some of the British people involved. And they had been training up a jihadi militant to take advantage of the civilian protests. So in no time, you had guns brought into the arena. And of course, the Syrian security forces responded in kind. But from day one, the peaceful protests were hijacked by trained jihadi militants. And the longer the conflict went on, the more it became very clearly not a struggle between the secular government and ordinary law-abiding folk who just weren't in favor of the government. The longer it went on, the clearer it became that this was a Western-backed insurgency by jihadi militants, following much the same script as in Afghanistan earlier, when the US trained up jihadis because they thought it would be good to fight the Russians there. And of course, it backfired. And it also backfired to some extent in Syria because it helped to spawn ISIS.
What was the Russian role? Because you mentioned them a few times in Syria. I think, as I remember, the round about, I think it was 2015, 2016, we had suddenly the Russians decided that they were going to go into and aid Assad. Now, I know they had a naval base there, didn't they, in the Mediterranean. So, of course, this might threaten the Russian influence in the Eastern Mediterranean. Am I right about that?
Partly right. The Russians went in because they saw that Assad was on the ropes. ISIS were literally at the gates of Damascus, just a few miles from the Umayyad Square at the center of Damascus. They'd come across the southern desert from the direction of Palmyra, and thousands of them were literally, the barbarians were at the gate. The Syrian government was tottering. The West stood by ready to applaud the jihadi takeover. The Russians were not going to just stand idly by. Syria had been a long-standing ally of Russia, although in recent years, before the uprising, Syria had been flirting with the West. And I was on kind of the receiving end of that when I was ambassador. I had better access to the rulers of Syria than the Russian ambassador had. So I think the Russians felt that they had perhaps an opportunity to claw their way back into a position of greater influence in Syria, but also in a very responsible way, they did not want to see an ISIS takeover of an important Arab country, not least because that could only spread the contagion back up through the Caucasus into Russia.
What about this business of Russian naval influence in the Eastern Mediterranean, though? Because, you know, we've got the US Sixth Fleet chugging around, and it has, as it has been since the end of the Second World War in the Med. And there's a certain amount of limits as to the power that can be projected from the Black Sea, so through the Bosphorus. And the Russians did see the Eastern Mediterranean as somewhere very important, where they could be a kind of really make sure that the US influence didn't completely prevail in the Middle East.
Actually, I think maritime bases generally, not just the Russian base in Tartus, are overrated. On today's battlefields, what matters much, much more is air power. And actually, there is another Russian base near Tartus, an air base called Khmeimim, which is today much more important geostrategically as well as locally. But the Tartus base is important, but, you know, look at our own wonderful aircraft carrier that limps around the world or when it manages to get out of dock. I mean, it's really just a bigger target for drones to hit. We saw during the US-Iran tanker war of a couple of years ago that the US had to withdraw their fleet 1,000 miles away because they were sitting ducks. They just make big targets.
Things have kind of moved on from Syria. The Syria is a battle which is some have compared to Stalingrad, others to the conversion of Paul on the road to Damascus. You know, an enormous sea change, really, in the post 9/11 spread of US influence around the world. Of course, it was going a long time before that, you know, with the first Gulf War, etc. But what do you make of a year on from the Russian incursion, what they call a special military operation, into Ukraine? They seem to have gained quite a lot of territory. They're now in the situation probably where it's very difficult for the Ukrainians to be firing actually into Russia itself. So they've created this kind of buffer zone, haven't they?
Well, I suspect that right from the beginning, it was never the Russian intention to annex Ukraine. I mean, we have to be serious about this, Tony. You know, the ignorant, and that's the vast majority of people in this country, assume that Russia just wanted to gobble up Ukraine. The evidence for this is extremely thin, non-existent, while there's ample evidence that the Russian objective from the start was A, to stop Ukraine falling into the sphere of influence of NATO and becoming a forward base just a few hundred miles away from Moscow, in other words, to ensure that Ukraine stayed neutral, not part of the Russian bloc, but simply neutral, like, say, Austria or Switzerland. How dreadful that would be, huh? And B, the Russian objective was to prevent a slaughter in the Donbass. The Ukrainians were giving ample signs that they were preparing a major military operation themselves to claw back lost territory to the local fighters in the Donbass, which, as we all know, is a predominantly Russian-speaking, Russian cultural area. So these were the twin war aims of Russia, not to annex Ukraine. That is simply not serious. But it serves the cause of Western propagandists, of course, because then they can say, oh, well, after Ukraine, they're going to gobble up Poland, and then they don't finish the sentence, because it is so manifestly absurd to imagine that the Russian cavalry are going to strike out across the northern European plain until they reach Calais. And yet, those are the terms in which the matter gets discussed in this country. I was just watching the Farage show, and it was in precisely these terms that it was discussed, that, oh, we have to stop Putin in Ukraine, because otherwise he'll be at our gates. I mean, this is cretinous. This is simply not serious. It's not possible to have a serious discussion of strategic affairs if the British side are going to speak like barroom drunks.
Well, yeah, but isn't that how wars happen? Is when two sides are so far apart there's no dialogue, and that's clearly what's happened. Even the Minsk agreements after 2014, the coup in Kiev, they started to look like there might be a basis for a settlement there, but they weren't kept to by the Ukrainians, and then obviously by the Russians. So it's very difficult, isn't it, to pitch this as a Ukrainian problem, because it's the Russians that have invaded, and it's now the Russians who are gradually taking territory off Ukraine.
That's right, and I think they are set to win the next round. They started a mini blitzkrieg, but it quickly ran out of steam. There was a big element of miscalculation there on the part of the Russians. But then they gained a great deal of territory in the east, and then the inevitable Ukrainian counterattack clawed back some of that territory. But now the Russians have been regrouping. They've mobilized over 100,000 new troops. They've manufactured a whole lot more weapons. And by the way, the little mentioned but very, very important thing in this conflict is the sheer availability of ammunition. And there are many reports that on the Ukrainian Western side, they're running out. The Western factories are not as geared up as the Russian factories. And this boring but very, very important element is going to count for a lot in the next phase. I'm fearful, however, that our governments are not preparing Western opinion for the inevitable Russian gains. It's going to come as a severe shock, which will create its own dangers that we might escalate from our side under the weight of this shock. We're entering a very perilous period now.
Well, I mean, we keep hearing about the Ukrainians winning, and they've got to hang on, and just so long as they keep going, Russia will lose. I look at the maps from time to time, and bit by bit, yes, there was a seemed a feint by the Russians, who moved in to the areas quite close to Kiev, and then it looked like they just decided, well, we've drawn away a lot of the Ukrainian army up this way, and now let's just disappear. So this isn't necessarily a victory for the Ukrainians. It's a tactical maneuver by the Russians. But if you look at the areas where they wanted to, you know, the Russian-speaking areas where the Putin a year ago announced that he wanted to secure, that seems to be where almost all of the Russian effort has been. And it has been a gradual process of taking over those parts of Ukraine. So, but what do you make of the accusations about the Nazi element? Because I'm not sure whether this is really justified. Putin certainly talks about the Nazis in Ukraine, and it might simply be that the Russian belligerence has inflamed Ukrainian temperament, and that more people are prepared to take these sort of extremist views.
Yes, I mean, I think it's valid to state that there is a strong Nazi element in the Ukrainian state, and that over the past 2 years, Nazi sympathizing elements have exerted a great deal of influence over Zelensky, and they're still there to this day. But it's also true that on the Russian side, they're making as much propaganda out of this as they can, not least because they have to motivate their own troops. Every country does this in a conflict. You have to galvanize the troops, and by brandishing the Nazi swastika, as it were, this does help to motivate the troops. The Russians have also been at pains to cast the conflict as a conflict not with Ukraine, but with America and NATO. And there, I think they're much closer to the truth. But we in the West have been using Ukraine as our cat's paw. And it's they, much more than us, who are paying the price.
Yeah. Also, in your diplomatic career, you must have met a lot of American diplomats and Russian diplomats, maybe even some Ukrainians, I'm not sure. Can you just give us an idea of, maybe take us through your assessment of these different nations? Because I know, although there are sort of basic diplomatic codes, what you're doing in your job is to try and assess, you know, what are these people really about?
Well, I must confess I was always struck by how serious and professional the Russians were. Almost invariably, they spoke excellent Arabic, whereas very few in the British or Western embassies spoke Arabic. I had a great deal of reluctant admiration for them at that time. The Americans were not serious. Most of their ambassadors are not professionals, but they're simply political appointees. And even those who are professionals are not terribly impressive for the most part.
What do you make of the Cy Hirsch article, which is laying the responsibility for the destruction of the German, largely German, based in Switzerland it was, the company, Nord Stream pipeline sabotage back in September last year?
The Nord Stream sabotage, yes, well, it's now indisputable, I would say, that it was America what did it. I mean, we have known this more or less for a long time, virtually from the very next day. And the Americans have not even tried very seriously to hide it, and their glee. But the revelations by Cy Hirsch have now blown it wide open. I'm not sure, actually, if the Americans haven't willingly leaked this information. They want the world to know how arrogant they can be, how blatant, how brazen, and send a message, especially to the Europeans, that they will not tolerate independence on the part of Germany or anybody else. If you Germans thought that you could do business with Russia, you better think again, because America won't allow it. That's the message that's being sent.
What do you make of Putin's speech today? He's announced that Lavrov last week, his foreign minister, was saying that they will grab the world's attention on the anniversary. That's Friday this week. And he's now also saying that they're pulling out of one of the most important nuclear treaties between the US and Russia. What do you make of his State of the Nation speech?
I thought he was trying to rally the troops. He was trying to motivate the troops in preparation for the big push which they appear to be about to make. And he was reminding the troops and his fellow citizens and the world of just what the Russian case is, that they were goaded into this by the West. it's well known that not everybody in Russia is on board. And let me note in passing that Russians are able to watch international media supportive of the Ukrainian and Western side, whereas we in this country are not allowed to watch Russia Today and other channels that might be supportive of Russia. Rather ironic that we try to pass ourselves off as champions of freedom of speech. Well, you're not allowed freedom of speech where Russia and Ukraine are concerned. Certainly, you won't get a platform in the mainstream media. So that's what he was doing today, essentially. And with the nuclear treaty being suspended, I think it was a rather desperate plea to the West to get serious. I mean, this is a very important treaty, the START treaty, a historic event when it came about in, I think, the late 70s. So this is really, really serious. By the way, most commentators on this side are trying to pass it off as nothing. This is balderdash. This is a very significant treaty. This step is very important and has to be assessed seriously. I think he's mistaken. It's not going to sober up our statesmen and the deep state behind them, or the corporate media. What strikes me about the entire discussion of Putin's speech today is the lack of sobriety on the part of the commentators. They're smirking as they comment on it. They are not. I said earlier that the level of debate in this country is that of a barroom braggart, and people are intoxicated on a toxic cocktail of Russophobia, NATO-philia, and jingoism. That's our trouble.
Why is this then? Why do you think there's such a big propaganda effort?
Because he's facing quite a challenge. The Russians are not stupid. They know that there have been reverses. They know that they're paying a heavy price, and so they need to be reminded. In fact, there is more freedom of opinion and speech in Russia right now on this issue than there is in the West. They do actually have people on their own mainstream media questioning what's being done with this operation. But here, you can go for months on end and not hear a single voice on the BBC or Sky or one of these others questioning the Western narrative. On the contrary, they see their role as cheerleaders. There's no two ways about it. Our media see their job as being cheerleaders and purveyors of our own propaganda.
Yeah, we've had US President Joe Biden pop up on a surprise visit yesterday in Kyiv. Now, he's done a speech today. I suppose this has all been arranged deliberately so that he can pop up on around the world's media, hopefully smothering Putin's coverage with his own speech. In Poland today, he's been saying that Ukraine's allies have got an iron will, as Putin is suspending the key nuclear treaty. He's saying an iron will, Peter. He's also pledging more sanctions. He says Ukraine will never have a victory, be a victory for Russia. And he says Ukraine still stands strong.
Yeah, it's vacuous bluster. Vacuous bluster and nothing more. There are no concrete elements in what Biden was blathering about. It was all emotional, boasting, braggadocio, bluster, American bluster. As you said, I think his objective was to spike Putin's guns. But I suspect he only did that for the already converted. I think in the wider world, particularly what we call the global south, that is everybody in the world except the Europeans, or most of the Europeans, and the North Americans. In the rest of the world, they tend to see things in a more sober fashion, because they're paying a price as well because of the spike in energy prices worldwide and grain prices. So they have stake in what's going on, perhaps more than we realize we have.
Well, yes, Putin was looking kind of steely-eyed and confident in his speech when he talked about the failure of the Western sanctions, and actually saying, well, actually, it's really helped us in Russia. We knew we needed to be a bit more self-sufficient and independent, and it's made us that. It's also vacated, I think he used, was the word he used, several areas in the Russian economy for Russian companies to take the place of the Western companies that have pulled out. I suppose he's not just thinking about McDonald's. But this is an aspect to this which is a real propaganda victory for the Russians, because the Western sanctions, Peter, seem to have really hit hard here. And I'm sure you and I are not the only people to have noticed that.
That's right. And this is why the Western politicians get away with it, because people don't realize, they're not allowed to realize that they are paying the price at the petrol pump and in their gas bills every day. And it's not just about the billions that we're handing over to the Ukrainians in equipment and direct aid. Much more than that, possibly in the trillions, we have the cost to the British economy and to British citizens' pockets. But this is totally obscured by the mainstream media. It is a taboo subject.
There's a meeting taking place, Peter, on Saturday in London, which has had a bit of a checkered history already before it's begun, which it's going to be announced, the actual venue is going to be announced the evening before on Friday night, because previous venues have cancelled, including Conway Hall, which is where the Communist Party was meeting during the Cold War, for example. George Galloway, former Labour MP, Workers' Party of Great Britain leader, Chris Williamson, Socialist Labour Party, which is Arthur Scargill's party, ex-Labour MP, very loyal MP, friend of Jeremy Corbyn's, who Corbyn kind of let go in the anti-Semitism scandal. We've also got the former diplomat, ambassador to Uzbekistan, and one of the greatest bloggers alive. I don't know how he keeps going at his blog, Craig Murray. Your good self, MEPs Claire Daly and Mick Wallace, Andy Hudd, who's vice president of the train drivers union, ASLEV, Max Blumenthal and Anya Parampil from the Grey Zone, which has been doing brilliant work, particularly around security stories, which the mainstream media don't cover, and of course the Julian Assange case, and there's a whole load, including our very own David Miller from Bristol here, who we had on our show last week, and a musician Lowkey. There's a list of them. The whole thing is going on all day, Peter. Can you say something about why we're in the situation where you can't announce a venue? Because I can remember back in 2003, we had a massive demonstration, Stop the War organised, against the Iraq war. And yet, when it comes to Ukraine, Stop the War coalition seem to have disappeared into the hedges. They've gone.
Yes, there is no peace party now, or even a peace movement. Stop the War have stopped fighting wars. And this has been happening over a number of years, but it's come to a head now. Naturally, not one of the main political parties could remotely be described as a peace party. And so it's left to a handful of individuals, mostly on the left, or who formerly identified as left. That's my case. I grew up thinking that I was Labour. I self-identified as Labour, and it's only recently I've discovered that I'm not really Labour at all. Certainly not today's Labour. I'm suffering political dysphoria. I don't know if I'm left or right anymore. I've been left behind, certainly, by the Labour Party. So this is the background against which the event is being held. And it's been extremely difficult to find a venue because of the bully boy tactics used by a mysterious opposition who contact the organizers of each place where we try to book and threaten them with violence. There'll be trouble at your meeting. Do you know that? Of course, the police do absolutely nothing about this. I mean, it is reminiscent of a fascist country. It has some of the characteristics of a fascist or a pre-fascist state, when you're simply not allowed to speak and violence is in the picture. But that's where we are in today's Britain.
Well, the Stop the War Coalition statement about Ukraine begins with, I'll quote them, Stop the War condemns the movement of Russian forces into eastern Ukraine and urges that they immediately withdraw alongside the resumption of diplomatic negotiations to resolve the crisis. Well, surely no one can argue with that.
That's a gross simplification of the situation and a cowardly stance from Stop the War. The Russians were goaded into taking their initial step. The West had been prodding them, advancing up to their borders, coordinating with the Ukrainians for the expected attack on the Donbass. The Russians had signaled for 3 months previous to their own move that they would have to take action if the West did not prevail on the Ukrainians to desist from this planned strike on the Donbass. And we ignored it. We smirked. We laughed at it, and we more or less invited the Russians to do their worst. I mean, that's a complicated picture. You can't just say the Russians were wrong to do what they did. They had their reasons. You may or may not agree with them, but they had their reasons. But the trouble is, Tony, that in this country, and we are an outlier. Here. We're an outlier in our up-to-the-hilt support for Ukraine. There's no other European country quite as blinkered as Britain. No other country in the world, even in America, there is considerable opposition. And in Germany, half the country is against getting sucked into the quagmire of Ukraine. But in Britain, we are blinkered by geography and history. Geography because we are conveniently far away from it all, and we've got the Channel protecting us. And history, well, it's almost 80 years since Britain was actually at war, in the sense of a conflict that was threatening the homeland. We have forgotten, and it all seems a long way away, and that is why we smirk and strike postures and indulge in barroom jingoism.
A poll in Politico, which is one of the most recent ones, Richard, shows 75% of Europeans are supporting the European Union's backing for Ukraine.
I haven't seen that. I'm not sure if it's accurate. It's certainly not accurate as far as the important German player is concerned. Polls there consistently show that the country is more or less split down the middle. Of course, in the UK, you can assume that 99% are behind the Western narrative, so that will weight the European average somewhat.
Polls in the UK are suggesting, this is an Ipsos poll from the end of January, they are actually suggesting that the British are okay, and they suggest that it would be good to provide Ukraine with weapons, but not to send troops. Now, how far away are we, do you think, of having actual British troops, American troops, etc., in Ukraine, NATO troops in Ukraine, even though, of course, they're not a NATO member yet?
I suspect they're already there. And I suspect they've already taken casualties because there have been denotices, that is, government censors ordering media not to report certain events, embarrassing military events, which I assume to mean that there have been British military casualties, special forces involved in taking hits in Ukraine, but the public are not allowed to know about that. Undeclared special forces are one thing. Open, overt committing of ground force troops is another. But you know, war today is conducted not just charges of cavalry and infantry on the battlefield. War is cyber. We're heavily involved in the cyber war that's going on. The information war, the economic war, the strategic war. We're advising the Ukrainians on tactics and strategy on virtually every level, apart from the basic level of having declared overt military presence on the ground. We're already at war with Russia.
It's totally unfair of me to put this to you, but we're being told, aren't we, by Lavrov particularly, to expect an attention-grabbing actions by the Russians at the end of this week, on Friday, apparently, on the anniversary. I wonder what you think that might be. And also, I mean, where we might be a year from now, it's worrying where this could go. Who knows?
Well, I would be myself greatly surprised if the Russians were foolish enough to launch any kind of operation on the anniversary. I mean, these are serious people, the Russians. I mean, this sounds like something that we might do, but I don't think the Russians would do it just because it's the anniversary. That would be to flag their intention. On the Ukrainian side, they'll be ready for every move. The smart thing would be to do it either tomorrow or in 2 weeks' time. It's already ongoing. Let us hold those who predict this event to account next week, Tony, in your program. Show who was right and who was wrong. But this is the trouble with us pundits. We're never held to account. We can spout any old nonsense, which sounds good for a day, but we're never held to account further down the track. This is one of the hallmarks of the British diplomatic service. You are never held to account. you moved on to your next job before you can be held to account. More seriously, I wouldn't be surprised if we we're still in a long war of attrition in a year's time. After all, this is how the Korean War went on for several years. And if indeed the West is determined to keep supporting Ukraine in its doomed struggle forever and ever and ever, then that's only going to prolong the agony. So we could be in a Korea-type situation a year from now. I think the Russians will do what the Russians always do, bring on the infantry steamroller. They're mobilizing literally hundreds of thousands of troops. And Napoleon learned this Russian strategy to his cost. Hitler learned this Russian strategy to his cost. And it looks like we're in for a reprise a third time. But it takes a long time for the steamroller to get up steam and to crush opposition. There's no doubt that the Russians are inferior in some areas of the battlefield. They've had several disappointments, but their air defenses are very strong. I dread our supplying British fighter jets to Russia, because they will have the agony of seeing them batted down like flies. The entire idea of throwing fighter jets into the fray is ludicrous. It's not even clear what their purpose would be. But there is no limit to the idiocy of the British discourse at this moment in time. We're drunk, as I said, on this toxic cocktail of jingoism, Russophobia, and NATO-philia.
Is Britain going to sober up, Peter? I noticed that Rishi Sunak at the Munich Security Conference, he did something unforgivable, really, which is exactly what Liz Truss did, which is to go off on a speech about, or it wasn't a written, it wasn't a pre-scripted speech, it was on a Q&A session, where he mistook the Baltic Sea for the Black Sea and had to be corrected by somebody in the audience. I mean, these people at the moment don't seem competent. Are we going to wake up?
No. There's no punishment for being ignorant and incompetent, and Truss has previous in this respect. Not the first time that she's made an error of basic fact. Sunak is supposed to be at least a competent technician, but he's similarly ignorant, has apparently no grasp of international affairs. And above all, is weak. He's in an extremely weak domestic position, so that he is buffeted by every wind. This is why he always ends up saying yes to everything and capitulating to everybody, except possibly the nurses. But on everything else, he's buffeted by the winds. And now Boris thinks he's onto a winner. Exploiting Sunak's weakness, while Boris can pose as the latter-day Churchill, who's going to stop Putin actually reaching Calais, and then the Tories will get rid of Sunak in several months' time, and because they know that they are doomed in the general election if they keep him on. And at that point, Boris will, the new Churchill, will come in on the strength of his magnificent positions on Ukraine.
Former ambassador to Syria and Bahrain, Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.